At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Monday, a clean slate, a fresh 5 days, plenty of time for us to figure out what the heck is going on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Monday, everybody. It's the 15th of August today, and it's almost like last week never even happened, isn't it? The markets are up, consumers are confident, companies are back in the business of buying each other, and we'll get to all that in due course. But mostly this week, it's all about what's going on. As I said, a thing we're calling the breakdown, our economy one step at a time. Today, where we are in the American economy circa mid-August 2011, and why what we call it actually does matter. First, though, the news this Monday. Driving things today was a small kick in the pants that Google gave Wall Street this morning. The search engine company is going to pay $12.5 billion for phone maker Motorola Mobility. And just because it can, Google's going to pay in cash. Our technology reporter Steve Henn is here in the studio today. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So what is this whole thing about?
Well, Android has been taking off.
Android, the operating system.
Google's operating system. It's exploding. You know, there are 500,000 new Android phones activated each day. It's overtaken Apple and BlackBerry as the most popular kind of smartphone in the world. And one of the reasons it's so popular is it's free to the companies that make the cell phones. So if you're HTC, you don't pay anything for it. But recently, Apple and also Microsoft have been suing companies that use Android, claiming patent infringement. And in a couple cases, they've forced companies to pay them licensing fees. And so this does two things if you're Apple, right? It brings new money in the door, which Apple obviously needs. And, and two, it increases the price of the phone that you're competing against.
Right.
So
right. That is the Android phones, right?
Yeah, that's the Android phone.
Okay. So how does Google buying Motorola Mobility help?
Patents. So Motorola Mobility helped invent the smartphone. It has a patent portfolio that's enormous, something like 17,000 patents. And when Apple takes, say, HTC to court, HTC doesn't have a lot of patents. Google didn't have a lot of patents. And they haven't had an easy time defending themselves. So they've basically lost. Now, if this merger goes through, when Google's partners are sued, Google will have their back.
Help me out here, though. Isn't that the way the marvelous American patent system is supposed to work?
Sure. You know, that's the purpose of patents. If you steal someone else's idea, you can get taken to court and you're supposed to pay for it. But lots of software developers believe the U.S. patent system, especially when it comes to software, is just broken. It's a total mess. There are literally thousands of patents issued for the same ideas. You know, for example, just in the last few years, Amazon was awarded a patent for creating social networks.
I love that, actually.
Yeah, no, so that idea has been done. And that kind of thing happens again and again. So Google, Apple, Microsoft have all gone out shopping, buying up thousands and thousands of patents. Most analysts believe it's largely for the purpose of suing each other.
Very quickly, is there any hardware aspect to this, controlling means of production and all that stuff on Google's part?
You know, I think that's the big question that we're going to be trying to puzzle out for the next week. Google hasn't been interested in hardware. It hasn't wanted to make stuff. What they do with the hardware operation that Motorola has is going to be a big question, you know. But interestingly, a lot of their partners, people they're now going to be competing against, like Samsung, HTC, came out in support of this deal. And they've pledged to keep making their Android operating system and making it available for free.
Marketplace's Steve Henn, our technology guy. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Clearly, Google's not just going to roll up into the fetal position and hibernate until the economy gets better. Neither, though, are other companies like Time Warner and Transocean and Cargill. They all announced plans today to spend billions of dollars buying other companies as well. But one does pause for just a moment, given what we've all been told is the parlous state of the economy. Isn't this, you could ask, a prudent time to hunker down? And to top it all off, why are companies making acquisitions anyway instead of hiring people on their own? Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore has that part of the story.
If you're one of the lucky Americans who has cash sitting around in a savings account, you know that's exactly what it's doing. Languishing, like a lump, earning you no interest whatsoever. Corporate America has the same problem.
There are oceans of cash available to buyers.
That's Bob Profusik. He's a partner with law firm Jones Day. He says today's burst of mergers and acquisitions is more evidence that companies, from tech to oil, are planning to grow.
I think you could argue that animal instincts have returned to the market. The stock market reacts positively to buyers who announce deals, so the actual M&A environment is extremely good.
A couple of bad weeks in the stock market won't slow these companies down. They don't want to just survive this economic malaise. They want to outrun it. So they'd rather plunk down billions to pay far above market price for an existing company, as Google did today, than spend years hiring new people and building new plants. Hyder Harris is a veteran investment banker with Harris Williams in Richmond, Virginia. I asked him what he's telling his clients.
If you can't build it, go buy it.
All these mergers are a vote of confidence from corporate America, says Harris, that the doldrums aren't forever.
Oh, I think it is an optimistic and properly optimistic bet on the future of the economy and the world.
The flip side, of course, is that these companies aren't hiring yet. When they do, the rest of us can share their optimism. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
So here's a question. You know how we were talking last week about volatility and how the volatility index has been up with all the crazy down markets lately and how increased volatility is a bad thing? So how come the volatility index goes down when the markets are up? I'm just asking. We'll have the details of Wall Street today when we do the numbers. If you're going to do a week of coverage about where this economy is right now, as we are, looking at what's really going on out there, we figured it'd be good to ask around a bit first, see what people think is going on out there.
We're going through a cyclical phase, is what you've gone through historically.
We got too many people wanting handouts instead of wanting to work.
We're helping the rich get richer.
We're paying the price for our investments in big corporation loopholes and the wars.
It's kind of on a downhill spiral.
People want to believe that it's really, really bad, so it is.
A lot of people are being hurt because there are people in Washington who just aren't paying attention to the things that really matter.
For a while, America was living on a credit card, and that got us, you know, the best seat at the restaurant, and now the bill is due.
That was, in order, Michael Prakar from Minneapolis, Todd Hayes in Jackson, Tennessee, Dorothy Winston in Nashville, Pam Victor from Pelham, Mass., Nick Caselli in Plymouth, New Hampshire, Joy Hamilton-Jones in Nashville, Trellin Smith in New York, New York, and Ben Skiers in Des Moines, Iowa. And it does kind of point out how tough it is to pinpoint exactly what is happening in this economy right now. Is it a double dip, a slow recovery, if you will, or something else entirely? To get a little bit of perspective, we turn to two people whose job it is to have a big picture of how things work, economically speaking. Justin Wolfers is an economist at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. Liaquat Ahmed is an investment banker and, more importantly, the author of The Lords of Finance, his Pulitzer Prize-winning book on the lead-up to the Great Depression. Gentlemen, good to have you both with us.
A pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Justin, the first question goes to you because there's an economics thing that I'm curious about. You know, we had the S&P downgrade. Everybody went bananas. And then you look around today and the markets are fine. There's a big merger announcement. Help me understand that.
Well, I'm not sure the chaos was about the S&P to start with. Over the past few months, we've seen a run of numbers that start to suggest that the recession was deeper than we thought. It's been going on longer than we thought. And the chances we escape easily are lower than we thought. And there was just a pause where sort of like, is it the Roadrunner or a coyote in midair, looks around, realizes there's not the support we had.
Gives a little beep beep and then, boom. Yeah.
And I think that really was people just waking up and feeling the run of numbers.
And then how do you explain today?
We generally tend to see when volatility goes up, it then slowly marches right back down. Hopefully what you just said will still be true by tomorrow morning. But as much as things are calm, in terms of economists watching the economy rather than folks thinking about the stock market, there's still a whole lot of fear that things in 2, 3, 4 years may still look pretty grim.
Well, seeing as how, Liaquat Ahmed, we're going to be dealing with this for a while, what are we in?
Well, we're in the aftermath of a giant bubble, which then burst and caused a banking crisis. And they dealt pretty well with the banking crisis, but they haven't been able to do very much about the aftermath, which is an overhang of debt. Ordinary Americans went into this recession having borrowed way too much money. And either the banks are going to have to write off some of it, or they're going to spend the next decade paying it down.
So, do I call it the Great Depression? I mean, what's the name? Is there one?
There was an economist, and I've forgotten who. Was it Irving Fisher who talked about debt deflation?
Yeah.
That's what we have.
Justin Wolfers, you have written and said, I think, on this program in a commentary or two that you think we're about halfway through a lost decade. What does that mean?
We're going to look back in, say, 2016 and wonder what we've achieved economically. And the answer is going to be not very much. Right now, average incomes are still lower than they were in 2006. And unless things really start to get moving, they're still going to be lower for another 3, 4 years. So maybe it's lost 8.5 years, maybe 9. But let's just call it a lost decade.
Not to put you on the spot, because I know economists hate that, but can I now go around telling people that, well, Justin Wolfers told me it's going to be better in 2016?
I sure hope so. The optimistic side is that. But I think realistically, things will be better in 2016 than they were in 2006. What they won't be, remember, economies normally grow.
Right.
So things won't be better in 2016 than they should have been, than we were hoping for, or than we otherwise expected.
Liaquat Ahmed, I'm going to read you a quote from your own book, talking about John Maynard Keynes, and you quote Keynes as saying this: "We have involved ourselves in a colossal muddle, having blundered in the control of a delicate machine, the working of which we do not understand." Obviously talking about the economy. Could have been written about today and what we're doing.
Well, I think the difference is we probably do understand a little more, but we lack the courage. I mean, maybe we could have avoided a double dip if the stimulus package had been larger. But the numbers were so large that the guys in charge just balked and said, you know, they just had sticker shock.
I think economic literacy can be really helpful. So if we think about the stimulus, hundreds of billions, TARP, $800 billion, these numbers naturally scare people. Mm. But they're all different. The stimulus, to the extent that we're building bridges today rather than tomorrow, and we're building them at a time when it's cheap because people are otherwise idle and wages are low. In fact, that's saving us money.
So, Justin Wolfers, if we get people like John Taylor from Stanford in here, they'll say, you guys are out of your mind. We don't need to spend more. We don't need more debt. We need to reduce that debt so that the government can grow organically. Help me understand that position and why it doesn't make any sense, because it sounds reasonable.
if you read John Taylor's economics textbook,
I try
it actually
to do
says,
that.
I'm paid to do that.
Yeah.
It actually says when an economy is in recession, government spending can be a powerful impetus to help you get out. If government debt were a problem, it would be a problem because government's borrowing so much that the private sector can't borrow. The symptom that you'd expect to see would be very high interest rates. The problem for business right now, and if you talk to any businessman, the problem isn't that the government is borrowing too much and they can't get a loan. The problem is that folks aren't coming into their stores and buying stuff.
Because they don't have jobs and thus are uneasy about pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Justin Wolfers at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Yaqut Ahmed, his book is called The Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
This is going to sound flip, but it's honestly not meant to. There is the not small matter of what to call what the economy's going through. Debt deflation, as you just heard, the lost decade, the tired old standby, the Great Recession. Because how we refer to something does affect how we react to it. Sasha Strauss is Managing Director and Chief Strategist at Innovation Protocol. That's a brand development firm. We've called them up. Sasha, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
Why does it matter what we call something?
I think that you have to respect that the general consuming mind is not synchronous. We're all thinking different things every day.
Yeah.
And so we often have to be told what to call things. We need a common reference point. And since we're all not sort of working together seamlessly, we need an advisor to suggest what we should call this so that we have common vernacular.
So if Ben Bernanke and the president and Timothy Geithner call you and they say, listen, Sasha,
yeah,
give me the elevator pitch. What do we call this thing that we're in? How do you go about that?
This economy has leveled the playing field for everyone. The races and cultures that used to be highly independent have finally integrated. And so if I was taking a call with the president, I would describe this as the Great Integration. We need a positive term. We can't keep calling this negative things.
But it's a negative thing.
It is a negative thing, but there's a negative term for everything. And if we keep focusing on negative energy, honestly, the consumer mind will never turn around.
All right. So the president's out today on this magical mystery bus tour.
Yes.
in the greater Midwest. Can he just start using the Sasha Strauss branding techniques and it's going to stick? Is that going to work?
For a nominal fee, he can. But in
special government
right,
rate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the answer to your question is that it takes pop culture leadership to create common vernacular. I would say that you, Kai, could absolutely propagate a definition, and as long as you rationalize it emotionally with the citizenship, explained why you came up with this term and what it implies, as long as they have that foundational definition, it can become the term.
Is it different now in the era where I can go out on Twitter and talk to however many people follow me than it was in Herbert Hoover's day when he had to get on a radio and
correct.
Talk to a couple of million?
So incredibly different. The power of social media has changed the way that cultures are influenced and vernacular is used, and so it simply takes someone with a mass audience of appeal to say something that sounds rational, and that's the trigger for it to become the way that people describe things.
Give me some tried and true branding methodology techniques that you can use to name this thing, right?
Right. So the traditional mechanism in brand development is to do research amongst the citizens, the consumers of the brand. So anytime you talk about Pepsi or Corona or automobiles, it doesn't matter what the brand is. What matters most is they didn't fabricate the answer out of nothing. I believe that we owe the same responsibility to the citizens if we're going to name this. That way, when we do ultimately create the name, it's not a Don Draper hypothetical moment. It's an aggregation of insights from the citizenship, and then we hand them the simplified term that helps create clarity.
Strikes me that there will be people listening to this who will accuse us of horrible, horrible cynicism, trying to wrap a brand around this cataclysm in our economy.
Yeah. And I do think that brand is often attributed with negativity. It's almost an attempt to influence the mind of a market by sort of connecting with what it is that they desire.
Yeah.
But please, Obama, a brand, the United States of America, a brand, Ford Motor Company, a brand, not just an economic stalwart. Every religion is actively managing its brand. So it's here. Why don't we orchestrate what we need to call this so that we all can synchronize our communication, focus on the destination in hand, rather than worrying about all the negative energy that's being distributed all the time.
I'm almost ready to stand up and salute and go marching on. Man.
Let's do this, brother.
Sasha Strauss is the managing director and chief strategist at Innovation Protocol. That's a brand development firm, in case you hadn't been able to tell. Sasha, thanks a lot.
My honor. Thank you for the time, Kai.
So to pick up on that idea that first you got to find out what people are thinking, we did.
Doomed. That's perfect.
Panic for no reason.
It's almost like an economic shock.
A depressive recession?
Depression, no doubt about it.
A mental recession?
Bummer.
Slow and uncertain.
What we call it doesn't really matter. It's a mess.
That was Janet Romo from Houston, Texas, Laurel Duncan, Travis Henderson, and Trevor Fisher in Des Moines, Iowa, Rick Prince and Joy Hamilton in Nashville, Tennessee, Richard Kahn, Matthew Mendel, and Morgan Mallsmith in Plymouth, New Hampshire. Coming up, the not-so-subtle link between market and emotional volatility.
I need help. I can't take this again.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials powered up 213 points today, nearly 2%, closed at 11,482. The NASDAQ bounced up 1.8%, 47 points, 25.55. The S&P 500 sashayed up more than 2%, 25 points, finished at 12.04. Companies connected to the mobile phone business rang up some big gains on that Google Motorola mobility buyout news. Motorola jacked up 55%, 55%. Nokia buzzed up 17%. Research in Motion picked off a 10% gain. They make Blackberries, in case you hadn't heard. Google stumbled down more than 1%. Other tech company rallied as well. Intel chipped up 1%. AMD rose 3.5% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.31%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing resource to 4 million small businesses, with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/marketing. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for July. The Federal Reserve releases its monthly industrial production report. And President Obama continues his tour of the Midwest with a rural economic forum at Northeast Iowa Community College. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have said this before, and we will say it again. In fact, why don't you just repeat after me? The markets are not the economy, and the economy is not the markets. So while the major indices did have a perfectly lovely session at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today, that doesn't mean that confidence about the markets or the economy has bounced back as well. Marketplace's Eve Troeh explains what kind of mind games are at play.
Last Monday, financial planner Jennifer Hartman says most clients wanted to talk. They fell into two camps. Let's call one Camp Resilient.
Clients who told me that we've been through this before, you helped us get it through before, we understand we're going to be fine.
The other, Camp No More.
Which is, I can't take this again. I need help. I can't take this again.
She says no one got out altogether. Some did move money around. And today, a week later?
I haven't had any phone calls or emails yet today.
Silence. But don't mistake that for relief. She says clients likely want to see how the whole month will shake out. Wall Street Journal columnist Jason Zweig disagrees with most analysts who call investors scared.
I think investors are angry.
Think of it as a marriage. Since that big fight back in 2008, some investors are resigned to rocky times, but they're sticking with it. For others, every fight now triggers the word divorce.
When people are angry, they do impulsive, impetuous things.
But that $40 billion or so dollars that left the market last week, he says that wasn't divorce. Not yet. More like a temper tantrum to send a message.
They don't trust politicians to do what's right. They don't trust regulators to make hard decisions. They don't trust Wall Street itself.
Zweig says investors are sick of officials and bankers telling them to be confident when they still have bruises from the 2008 tumble. The pain of the fall makes a bigger impression than the recovery, says author William Poundstone. In his book, Priceless, he compares losing stock value to jumping in cold water.
It feels freezing the first time you jump in a pond, no matter how many years you've jumped in that same pond. Likewise, any time you lose 6% of your retirement account in a given day, even if you have memories of that happening before, it's still going to sting.
That sting could mean holding off on a new TV or new clothes or a car, a lack of confidence that shows up in the everyday economy. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
So let me do a little public radio foreshadowing here. One of the steps we're going to take this week to break down our economy is to look at jobs, where they are, where they're not, and what anybody can do about it. There's been a big push this year at the state level that's tied up with jobs and immigration. Employers in Alabama and Georgia are now going to have to verify new workers that they hire are legal, which got commentator Gustavo Arellano thinking about his own experience.
I have a confession to make, one I'm quite proud of. I've had illegal immigrants work for me before, and I can't wait until they work for me again. I can't wait to have them hustle for me for nada, to eat the fruit of their labor while they toil anonymously. God bless American capitalism. Of course I kid. Kind of. See, I wanted to pay these workers, all of them interns for me over the years. They're amazing, hardworking college journalists who'd be fine additions to any investigative news team. But after they finished their internships, I couldn't hire them. My employers don't hire illegal immigrants. And I couldn't recommend the Cub reporters for jobs at other papers for the same reason. The case of Jose Antonio Vargas resonated with me. Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who recently confessed he's in this country illegally. He arrived to the U.S. from the Philippines at age 12 and has lived here ever since, assimilating seamlessly. It's amusing to see former editors sanctimoniously distance themselves from Vargas now that he came out as undocumented, because he had fake papers. But really, what changed? His legal status? Poppycock. Obviously, that didn't stop him from winning journalism's highest award. But it's great to see this drama play out in the front pages of the newspaper industry because it prominently illustrates a much bigger point sometimes lost in our immigration wars. American employers know exactly whom they want to hire, and sometimes it's not about the cheapest wages, but rather the best worker. The government should concentrate more on making sure employees get a fair wage and work in safe conditions instead of whether they're legal. The Department of Homeland Security just announced they're issuing 1,000 new I-9 audits to make sure businesses aren't hiring illegal immigrants, because what our economy really needs right now is more bureaucracy. Taking jobs away from citizens? Please. My interns were the best and the brightest of their respective applicant pools. No affirmative action under me, folks. I can't wait for the day when I can find jobs for Julio, Matias, Luis, Fernando, and the rest. Until then, they have to waste their talents on great tweets or pithy Facebook status updates. And that's just a shame.
Gustavo Arellano is the managing editor of the OC Weekly. If you've got a comment, send it to us. Online works best. Marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals, on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final, if somewhat amazing, note on the way out today, courtesy of the good people at Gallup. The next time somebody tells you Washington's out of touch, that they just don't get it, you go right ahead and believe them. A Gallup poll out today says Washington, D.C. is far and away the most economically confident area in the country. Gallup offers something it calls the Economic Confidence Index. National average the first half of the year, -28. Washington clocked in with a plus 11. And I'm just going to leave that right there. And tell you this, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Monday. Today, the Dow powered up 213 points, nearly 2%. The NASDAQ bounced 47 points higher, 1.8%. The S&P 500 gained 25 points, more than 2%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. The latest installment of The Breakdown, Our Economy One Step at a Time, is tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. And coming up next time back here, unemployment up close.
This past week or two, I've seen people in a highly specialized medical field where they've personally done leaps and bounds to save the company money just out the door because of generalized cuts.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.